talk this week because nothing's happened in the news. So well, I guess we'll just sign the program off now.
You're funny, Bill. Oh. You know, I just piled up the newspaper articles when I cut the paper each week. You know, I put things into sections because I take 8 papers a day and I have a section of things to read right away and then things I can read later, pretty soon, and then eventually. They go into 3 different piles. And then the right away I separate into whether I want to copy them and cross-file them or put them in particular categories. And that right away box was so filled up this week because so many things are coming down. You know, well, it's almost election time, which isn't important, but it is important in our scene. In fact, I thought I'd do a little resume of the election scene now because we're almost the end of June.
Okay.
What's
now
really
the
happening?
May Brussels summary of what's happening in the election.
What's happening with the election year? I thought I would give my listeners a break this year and talk about all the good things in the news for 1972. Because we come down, everyone says, oh, that was really a heavy show, and that's pretty bad. You know, all this news, I've been putting a heavy trip of conspiracy and government overthrow on everybody for so long. So I thought maybe this week is a, sort of an anniversary of the show being on just about a year. We talk about some of the good things that are coming down and how they show up in the news during the week, and that would be a new twist. I got that idea because of the news that broke this Monday. It was last Monday on the bugging of the Democratic headquarters by the top officials in the Republican snooping department, and I thought that was really a marvelous way to catch them gumshoeing at their very worst, you know, clumsily and dressed up in their dinner suits with rubber gloves and the whole thing. I cross-filed that break, that so-called robbery, Mitchell calls it a robbery, into the Republican office, and I did a lot of work on that this week. And that made me happy, and it brought to mind all the good things that have happened in terms of 1972. So we'll go into those. The first thing was the Pentagon Papers, the break of the Pentagon Papers. The story that Ellsberg had, it was just last June, of how the government works. What the Pentagon Papers revealed is how the government has no major decisions, or whoever making them, never. He plays his hand so close that the members of the National Security Council that correspond back and forth don't indicate through them who's giving the orders, like to Henry Cabot Lodge or Ellsworth Bunker. Somebody above there, and it isn't the president, is manipulating this situation. You hear very little of President Kennedy in the Pentagon Papers. Have you ever read them, Phil? It's a great book. I brought a copy, and it's practically threadbare. I love to read them. One of the things that's important in the Pentagon Papers, on page 173, is that DM was making overtures to the North and knew that Lodge reported, Henry Cabot Lodge reported, hearing that Mr. New was secretly dealing with Hanoi and the Viet Congs through the French and Polish ambassadors, and both of these governments favored a neutralist solution between the North and South. Now, when I say whoever pulls the strings in Washington does not want peace in Asia, it is evident through the Pentagon Papers, and this is just a sample, goodness knows how many other secret papers are locked up, it's a sample of the overtures that were put back, and you were never led to believe that these men wanted to end that war on their soil. Since the Pentagon Papers came out, you see that Ho Chi Minh wrote to Washington many times and didn't want the communists to come down and take over North Vietnam. And those letters were kept from the President of the United States. I think people want to know who is the organization, who is the group behind it. The Dulles brothers are as close to controlling the minds of this country as any two teams. I refer to them all the time. John Foster Dulles, who ran the State Department, from the time World War II was over, he controlled Eisenhower's decisions for 8 years, and Allen Dulles, the attorney who represented people who financed Hitler, he formed the CIA, and Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, represented members of the Council on Foreign Relations, the oil people, the Buckleys, the Rockefellers, those were their cousins, the very rich. And it seems that the Dulles brothers made the decision not to accept the Geneva Accord in Vietnam and just go ahead with the war. So Diem was making overtures. That was in the Pentagon papers, and then Paul Kattenberg, who was a diplomat for 39 years in Asia, had proposed to President Kennedy that we have disengagement, that the war couldn't be won with or without Diem, you know, that they should pull out. And the advisors, Robert Kennedy, brought up the question of disengagement. There was conversation, let's get out of there, we can't win it. And there were a few people that wanted to stay in, and one was Lyndon Johnson. He says, we'll stay till that war is won. Of course, Lyndon Johnson is closely tied in with Murchison and Conley and Richardson and oil people. And the Buckleys have oil money. They're Texas family originally. Johnson represented a large block of the wealthy oil people and the military people. And the Southern armament, he was the head of the space agency as vice president. He sat over NASA and the space agency. And they wanted a war in Asia. And Lyndon Johnson and Dean Rusk said, we will not pull out till the war is won. And no matter what the advisors who had studied the situation for years said, that's what Lyndon Johnson wanted. Now, there was a meeting on October the 30th in 1963. This was 2 days before Diem was killed. And McGeorge Bundy said, my general view is that the U.S. is trying to bring this medieval country into the 20th century, and that we've made progress, and we have to have a military victory to bring them into the 20th century. You really have to look at the map of Vietnam and the situation today with the villages and the bombings, even in South Vietnam and North Vietnam, and the weapons, and what we've done to that country, and realize that that's his version of the 20th century. We have to bring them into the 20th century. Therefore, Diem, 2 days later, Diem was killed, and then 3 weeks later, Kennedy was killed. But the important, I want to go into the importance of the Pentagon Papers, is we get a glimpse into how our history is written and who is making it through reading these documents and letters that were going back and forth. And we have a lot of domino theories, I call them domino theories, working at home like they had contrived in Asia. And one of the domino theories that we have to be very optimistic about was that when Daniel Ellsberg developed a conscience and began to talk to us about the way the government makes its decisions on this terrible war, and he surfaced, and he's on trial now for a very serious charge, you know, that the government has to pin down and punish him for what he did. As soon as he surfaced, he inspired other people. Now, Lewis Tackwood, the informer for the LA Police Department, who worked for them for many years, 9 years, a black man, surfaced on the basis, he said, of what Daniel Ellsberg did. He wanted to tell what he knew about the LA Police Department. So he worked part of the time for Criminal Conspiracy Section, which plans conspiracies. And he tells how you plan them in the state, in Los Angeles and the whole state of California, and they affect national conspiracies. Did you see the last issue of Nose that came out, the
yes.
local community
yes.
paper? Did you read the Tackwood papers? They're marvelous. There's a local paper called The Nose in Carmel. People in Santa Cruz should be able to get it. Inquire at KLRB or write a letter to me, and we'll mail you a copy. The Sandal Spot in Carmel here has them, and I think people should get this copy of The Nose, this four-page insertion of the testimony of Lewis Tackwood. I speak about him on the show all the time. And there's four pages of testimony from a book coming out called The Glass House Tapes.
Okay, while we're talking about it, there are a bunch of locations where you can get the county, Monterey County Nose in Monterey, the Military Law Project, the MPC Bookstore, the Women's Center, the Genery, Cannery Road, Polygon, the Whole Earth Craft Center, Oz, Natural Food Store, and PG, the Camera Exchange, Chili Gorts, Alpha Books, Carmel Sandal Spot, Esperanto, Carmel Vintage Shop, Seaside at the People's Parts House, Archie's Gas, Harambe, Legal Aid, Hall's Grocery, the Academy of Music, and Salinas at Monterey County Peace Center, CRLA, and United Farm Workers.
Yeah.
Now, as to what's in it.
As to what's in it, I think the Esperanto isn't carrying it now, but the other shops are. What's in it is a four long pages of direct testimony of tapes that Lewis Tackwood made at the L.A. Describing the L.A. Police Department. And if we're talking about conspiracies, he describes the conspiracy in California that is linked to the national conspiracy. He said he worked part of the time with S-1-1, which was surveillance, intelligence, and investigation of the L.A. Police Department. He worked in Criminal Conspiracy Section and Squad 19. And that orders for all of these things for Squad 19 is headed by Ed Birch. And orders come from the State Department of Justice, Evel J. Younger. on these special squads, and that these, he says, the intelligence gathering is linked up with a complete statewide and federal intelligence operation. I think the people who listen regularly to my shows and want more detailed information on the state conspiracy should get a hold of the Nose. It's a very good issue, and read every word of it and underline it. You know, I have a copy of the testimony of Tackwood to this particular group that are putting out his book, but I keep reading it over. It tells the structure of the national conspiracy, the state conspiracy, and the kind of thing I'm talking about. And it's hard to catch it in a one-hour show. I talk fast and move along, but you can get it in your local newspaper and read about it. Now, Ellsberg is talking about government deception in a particular war in Vietnam. Tackwood surfaced to talk about working in criminal conspiracy, planting evidence against people to create conspiracies, to get certain persons arrested that the government doesn't like, planting evidence on them, sending them to death row, being paid to kill them. And his works, he refers to the organization. It's in Washington, its headquarters, and some of it comes from Texas. He refers to Texas. And it also is linked with the FBI and the mafia. So Tackwood surfaced this year and told the structure of the L.A. Police Department. And because Tackwood surfaced, Frank Martinez came out, and he's a Chicano who worked for the L.A. Police Department, the Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Pitches. And he told about jumping on cars and starting riots and breaking up groups of Chicanos who got together for the sole purpose of bettering their human condition. They weren't against the government. They're not so-called communists, whatever that is. They're not radicals. They were Chicanos getting together to better their position for job opportunities and educations. And those leaders are locked up. They're put into situations of riots. They're killed at the riots. They're brutalized. They're completely infiltrated. So Frank Martinez came out this year and told about the Chicano community and the agents there. Larry Shears surfaced, and he works for the Treasury Department. And he realized that there was a plan to kill Cesar Chavez, and he surfaced, and maybe he not only will have saved Chavez's life, but he has told the structure of the Treasury Department and the chain of command of payoffs in that area. And Larry Shears also told about the Treasury Department making deals, we did a show on this, with to kill Eldridge Cleaver. Now, this is a good sign in 1972, that because I know that this government works on secrecy. Conspiracy involves secrets. And if you don't know who is going to catch you or who's listening to you, you have to send people around the world like Richard Nixon is doing now. You can't have any secret memos anymore. Everybody can see them and see the deals. He's got a bunch of monkeys, I call them the monkeys, flying all over, because he's in a very critical position in terms of American history right now. Richard Nixon has been the front man for a group of people that controlled the White House since World War I. When Kennedy won the election against him, Kennedy could be taken away, Robert Kennedy could be taken away. Richard Nixon now thought he had competition in 1969. He thought Ted Kennedy could win the election from him, maybe, and they took care of Ted. Now they're stuck with a lot of strategy. The Southern strategy has been blown by Wallace, and Wallace lived, and Richard Nixon has to make some important decisions. And he's got to make a lot of assurances to people who've put him into power, who keep this government going there. And he's got Kissinger off in China, and he's got Connally at various nations, and he has other important secretaries going to South America, and he's got Rogers now going to the Middle East and Iran. They're duplicating their steps. They're following behind each other. If you read where they are in South America, Rogers is going to the same countries Connally went to. But only certain men can carry the memos to these countries. They cannot send messages like they used to do. Incidentally, I suspected Richard Nixon in 1960, the night that he lost to John Kennedy. He ran down to Tijuana and had lunch in some restaurant down there, met the mayor of Tijuana, and went to the men's room and came back to the Ambassador Hotel, and supposedly his wife and family, and nobody knew where he had split that day. And I called Drew Pearson in 1960 and said, can you find out who Nixon was with in Tijuana? Because I felt he was getting paid off before he lost the election, in case he would lose it to Kennedy. because he put his election on the line with those debates on Quimoy and Matsu, and I thought the China lobby was paying off Nixon to, even if he lost, that he would be taken care of. And it was funny because 2 years later there was an article about a certain exchange of money in a men's room between the China lobby and Richard Nixon. I have that article. This was a few years later.
By who?
It was a newspaper article about a group of people that had given Richard Nixon, it was, again, I think, by Drew Pearson, years later, on the implication that he was paid off in cash by a group of people outside the main dining area in this particular hotel or restaurant. And I filed it away. Oh, it's put way back. This was, well, the election was in 1960. I guess the article later was around 1964 about his meeting some people from China who had handed him cash in almost the manner which I could visualize it having in 1960. And I think Drew Pearson, I contacted him then about it. But he would never admit, you know, like, he was alive at the time. He never would admit there was any connection between the first thing, the first suggestion and the second. But the articles paralleled, and they came 4 years later, the people that I thought he would be meeting. But getting back to the domino theory of exposure, Larry Shears came out and told about the plans to kill Cleaver and Chavez, and he said, there's too much killing going on. I don't like it. People have a right to live, even if I don't agree with them. And he surfaced. Now, Colonel Hebert surfaced from the Army. He resigned from the Army, and there's an interview of his in Playboy this month. And he tells of the murders in Vietnam. And he served in Germany in the Army Intelligence, Africa, Middle East, Dominican Republic. He was a lieutenant colonel high up with intelligence, sent to Vietnam to work with the special forces in intelligence. And he was almost ready to become a general. And he had orders to go into the villages and kill the women and children and leave the evidence around that the Viet Cong did it. Then we could show them what the Viet Cong did and come back and take an avenge, you know, what they had done and go after them because they killed these innocent women and children. And Colonel Hebert just reevaluated everything that he saw in Vietnam, and he wrote, I guess he'll have a book coming out, but he has an interview in Playboy, and this is something that I can't do the whole thing on the show because it's this month and you have access to it. You people are interested. You can read what he says about Vietnam and the officers there. And if he speaks, not somebody else is going to speak up. Another officer put a charge against Lavelle, that general that retired this week for bombing on his own. He was tied up with NASA and the space agencies, and he was bombing North Vietnam at the time we were having so-called peace talks. So the government retired him at $2,300 a month. But now there's a lawsuit, you know, to remove him entirely and to prosecute him for what he did. So another officer in the service is speaking up. Then we have Victor Marchetti. He worked with the CIA most of his life. And he studied, he had a career in Soviet studies, Army intelligence, National Security Council. 14 years he was the executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA. He resigned in 1969 to expose the CIA for what it was. And he wrote The Tightrope Dancer, a novel about the CIA. And he has a second book about the CIA, which is even heavier. And it was a judge ordered it not to be published. Well, maybe it'll be published in Europe. The point is that the top officials, I'm using, you know, not the person at a lower level who defects gets completely swallowed up, and even the top officials who want to write a book can't get it published. But it's telling you where their head is at. The first defection that took place years ago in 1965 was Hans Tuft, one of the top agents of our CIA, who worked with the underground Free French against Hitler and tried to free Europe from oppression. He's Belgium, and he worked with the CIA. And after Kennedy was killed, he was sick about the American invasion of the Dominican Republic, the recognition of the military in the Dominican, and the killing of Kennedy. And he was writing, took home notes to write memos to expose the CIA. He was the first one. It was about 64 or 65. I don't recall which year. I have all the files of his defecting, and he had an ad in the Wall Street Journal, wanted one agent for hire. He left the CIA, and I've never heard about him. I don't know if he's alive or dead. They use all kinds of aliases and can die somewhere in a rooming house from another name. I haven't heard a thing about Hans Tuft, and I've sent out letters. He had a fake law degree from the office of John J. McCloy and worked out of New York. And I don't know where he is now, but he was the first defector, but he didn't get the publicity or the attention that Marchetti has gotten. Now, the way that there's another fellow who defected this week who's not so famous. His name is Risley Claiborne Papitrici. I guess you saw him. He's a lawyer from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who worked in the legislature. And 12 years ago, he stood up and was for segregation. Did you read the article, Phil?
No, I didn't.
Oh, yeah, he takes it all back now. He said that you can read that. He said, I don't want to leave my children with a legacy that their daddy was a bigot and a racist. He's a state legislator down in Louisiana, and he was against segregation, against equal job opportunity. And he realizes he's wrong. He said, I had a firm conviction I would not
against, he was against desegregation.
He was against desegregation. Yeah, he feels that his mistake in the 60s was wrong, that the position he took was wrong. And he's now, he wants more job opportunities and for blacks, and he wants the desegregation. And he doesn't want to be remembered as a bigot. So maybe the train of defectors will get larger. I can't keep a collection of people with a conscience that are speaking up. And I hope that this domino theory works as well as the Asian one, or better, because theirs isn't working, you know. But I think that the people that speak up should be recognized, and in some way, there isn't enough of that. There aren't enough people accepting the good news every day along with the bad. Now, there was a certain script, I felt, for 1972 that our intelligence agents wanted, and I saw it working to an effect all through this from 68, from the time Martin Luther King and the riots, up to 72. And I see a break on that. I don't see it rolling the way that Nixon and company want it. And this is the good sign. Like I said, Phil, I always talk about the bad things, but this is the way I see this script, and this is the way it isn't going the way they wanted it. The student riots at Kent State and Orangeburg and Isla Vista were filled with provocateurs, and the students objected to the war in Vietnam. What happened is the war got bloodier every day, but the students aren't rioting. They seem to, I don't know how they're realigning themselves, they're dropping out of the system, they're not watching the television or using the plastic credit cards, and they're not part of the same culture that Mama and Papa were. But they're not going to be lined up and shot like at Kent State, and they're not going to be fooled by the provocateurs. The students are aware of the provocateurs on campus and or at any organization. They can spot them, they talk about them, and they seem to be more aware of them. So that the student rioting, the war is bad, but I'm sure that the president thought with this increased bombing that we would have more rioting before the elections. And we're not rioting. People are signing petitions and lining up with the governor, which Nixon never thought they would. You know, he thought there'd be more outward emotional expression.
Do you think the fact that a lot of young people have the vote is making a difference, too?
I think the fact that they have the vote is making the difference, and I just think that they realize that they're getting out on the streets and yelling about the war is not as important as maybe going to law school and medical school and working with the oppressed and voting out Nixon, yeah, trying to vote him out. I think it makes a difference being able to vote at 18, from age 18 to 21. And because there's nothing they could do but get on the street and thrash. They couldn't take their parents to the poll and move their hands. So I think having that age group from 18 to 21, having that ballot in your hand has made a difference. Knowing that you have some say has made a big difference rather than marching around the street.
Yeah, there have been a lot of elections decided so far by youth vote, especially sure. Local elections.
Well, look, McGovern took New York. I mean, you know, it's just something that Mitchell and company had not anticipated, or if they anticipated by letting the 18-year-old have the vote. I think they believed through the hysteria, law and order, and the riots, that if they escalated a lot of these things and people protested, they could say, oh, look how they're protesting. But the student riots have been practically nothing, and there's nowhere even to put their old provocateurs, you know. Then the prison riots, they had Attica and San Quentin, and there was Florida riots and New Orleans. And what happened was that the sympathy went to the prisoners. It didn't go to the prison system. That enough people said, look, what's happening? And enough lawyers spoke up and journalists spoke up. And after Attica, maybe Rockefeller proved himself in the hardcore Republican Party. You know, I always say as if he needed proof. But I don't think the prison riots, the Tackwood papers here tell how the police department had foreknowledge of the San Quentin riots long before they took place when George Jackson was killed, and how he had a big part in trying to frame Angela Davis, how the L.A. Police Department used him through the criminal conspiracy section to work on the Angela Davis thing, and they hoped through the San Quentin riot that they would get Angela Davis and Jackson and everyone in one fell swoop, and the sympathies would be with the people as against those terrible rioters out there. Well, it didn't work that way. You see, you had Bobby Seale was up for trial, and imagine what would happen in this country to the blacks and to the general population of Seale and Angela Davis and the Soledad brothers and the Berrigans and the L.A. Panthers were all guilty, and they were all locked in jail, and people knew they were innocent. But it didn't work that way. They were all acquitted. Because, you see, every day that we communicate through the radio, through the press, underground press, or even the ordinary press, and the media, maybe I'm reaching somebody who's going to sit on a jury someday. And they can try that on trial for what it's worth. But if they hear that there are conspiracies, if they read about evidence that's planted, if they read how you hire ex-convicts to give testimony against somebody, it will ring a bell when it comes time to vote on that jury. Somebody listening today is going to be on a jury. And out in Salinas at that courthouse, they're going to want to frame some person, and they're going to know what planted evidence is, you know, and they're going to know what witnesses are who are bought off from the top level to the local level, because we jump around on these subjects. So that all of these things, the Berrigan Trail, they were acquitted, and Angela was acquitted, and Bobby Seale, and the Panthers. So the legal system, even with their prosecutors, Aaron Harris from L.A. that was brought up against Angela, he fell apart. He didn't even have a case. So that is a good sign, I think. Now, there's other signs like the pop festival. They tried to come down on the kids with the music festivals. The Aldemont was staged by the CIA. They had the camera on the killing. The vibes were bad. Those were provocateurs using the Hells Angels and a group to come down to show that the youth are violent. It didn't work. The youth just gave up their pop festivals. They weren't going to be stabbed. They weren't going to be given bad drugs. They weren't going to be trampled on. So they gave up their pop festivals. And the Rolling Stones moved now into awful places like the Palladium or Carnegie Hall. And you have a choice. You can either go or not go. And the kids have built their own resources. They don't even go to the pop festivals. If you give them good music, like Joan Baez was there and it was $2 a person and the vibes are good, they'll go. If it's a plastic thing, if there's danger, if it's expensive, they're not going to go. So they diverted their energies away from these scenes that the establishment wanted them to have. They've redirected their energies, which is very good because the image of the youth was built up through the Manson, framing Manson, and the story on the occult. And the system wanted you to come down on the youth, but it didn't work because this generation is the most honest generation. All the young people, or most of them that I know, they don't have prejudices. They don't have hatreds of other races or economic classes, and they don't put on any airs, and they're not phony, and they don't consume themselves with fashions or throwing names around. I think they're a far-out generation, and they're cool. They're keeping cool. And this is something that you can't take over and overthrow a government if everybody's keeping cool. You don't have an excuse. Out of the script of the 1968-69 script of the CIA came the cover story for Time last week on the occult revival. This is outdated. This was to tie in Manson and the scare. They mentioned Manson in here. And to make the older generation, to compensate for the youth vote, they want the older people to get out and get scared. That we're going into witchcraft or magic. It's not going to work. I don't think anybody was interested in that cover of Time or the occult revival at all. Nobody talks about or thinks it's pertinent to today's times. What's your reaction to this kind of a thing, Phil? Do you think it's pertinent?
I don't know. There are a lot of incidents cropping up around the country in the news. You know, they're isolated and scattered, but, you know, small towns that have little groups of young people, if you believe the reports, that are practicing different cult revivals.
Oh, you know,
I mean, it's cropping up in the news. I don't know whether it's manufactured or not.
I think they're planted. There was an article in the L.A. Star last week, the newspaper, about Manson, and that if Thomas Noguchi could tell the truth, he'd tell about all the human blood that Manson drank. I don't think that's true. I think those are planted stories. I just don't believe it.
Okay, we'll be back with more of